How's your fantasy team doing, mate?
Oh, I haven't checked it in ages. Everyone's bored by this stage of the season now, aren't they?
That's enough out of you, you whiny limey. That's soccer, not football. And this is Paddy Power's NFL Fantasy. Running on just the 6 p.m. games, it's only a game week long. No season-long boredom. No excuses. And £750 in prizes guaranteed each week. Paddy Power Fantasy. Hate waiting, love winning.
Paddy Power Fantasy rules apply. 18 plus begambleaware.org.
Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombe Show presented by Paddy Power Fantasy. Good to have you with us this fine Wednesday. I and Mike Carlson dropping by very shortly to get in to, well, his power rankings. Looking forward to that. We'll talk a little bit about Monday Night Football, the return of Eli Manning and what that means for the NFC East race, the race that no one seems to want to win. We'll get into officiating as well, unsurprisingly, after that Patriots-Kansas City game. It is Mike's favorite subject, let's face it. So, of course, we're going to talk a bit about that. And indeed, the latest controversy surrounding the New England Patriots and Bill Belichick. More of that shortly. Just a shout out to our top sponsors, Paddy Power Fantasy. Appreciate all their support this season. Not least the Listener League, the show league that they've been putting together for you to get involved with. Free to enter daily fantasy cash prizes to be won, rolling on once again this weekend. I know lots of you have won, having played already, so good fun. Get involved. fantasy.paddypower.com/league/Nat Coombe Show. Pretty easy. Ben Isaac's dropping by a little bit later on in the show as well, to talk through the college playoffs. They've been sorted, the final four. The Heisman Trophy gets announced this weekend, so who's going to win that? And indeed, is the recipient a lock and load for the number one overall draft pick? All of that to be revealed a little bit later on, but we'll kick things off, of course, with Iron Mike. Iron Mike, how you doing?
Well, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas at Oblique House here.
In what way have you got? Let me guess. Sinatra on. You got vinyl Sinatra.
Not quite. But the Christmas tree did go up last night, and unfortunately, it's a little bit smaller than I thought it was. It looked nice, so. But then when I brought it home, and my problem is that I tend to accumulate ornaments because I try to get one every year. I picked up this beautiful Vincent Van Gogh,
an original
Japanese, yeah, his original Christmas ornament, yeah. At the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. And, so that has pride of place this year, but I've got my Super Bowl one, my Bridgeport Bluefish one, the Boston Celtics one
that,
got broke last year. Yeah. I put one up yesterday. It's not a very good photo though, unfortunately.
Well, we'll get Alex and the boys to nab it and push that on our channels. When you said I got the dimension of the tree wrong, I immediately thought of Spinal Tap and Stonehenge. one of my favorite scenes in the history of cinema. Look it up, kids, if you don't know what I'm talking about.
I was thinking, you know, if Stonehenge were open the way it was when I first went there back in 1972 or 3, I was thinking of spending Christmas there.
Oh, the hippie era. We've got the hippie era, Carlson. We've got the Magnum State Trooper cop era of the early 80s with the Tash. I mean, there's so much good stuff here in the history book. Now, Mike Carlson, can you account for your whereabouts on Sunday around the Cleveland, Ohio area?
I do have proxies who I can get to do. My little micomaniacs are available for many, many, many small tasks. But yeah, isn't it great that the Browns are like one of these stories that keeps on giving, you know?
Unbelievable, but they really are.
Now I know what you're talking about. We've got to go to the Cincinnati Bengals.
But no, it's a fair point that the Browns are a story. Yeah, keeper. It would be there, of course.
That was, said around Cleveland, I was thinking, yeah, maybe me and Odell got to go out for another drink and talk things over again.
Baker Mayfield, way to go, incidentally.
Yeah,
in
but
terms
this
of
whole spy
under the bus.
Yeah, this whole Spygate 2 thing, I think, is going to be.
Let's recap the story for the
yeah.
Benefit
the story.
Of any
the story is the Patriots were filming the Cincinnati Bengals while they were playing, which is with a camera from the press box, which is illegal for a team to do. They can only take video footage that's released via broadcast or via the league.
And it was clandestine. So their argument.
Well, that's what they're saying. It was clandestine. Now the story is that according to Adam Schechter, at least, that the Patriots were doing a feature for their own website on advanced scouts. So they had a camera crew with the advanced scout who was up right. in the press box.
So they've got a series called Do Your Job, and they follow a different member of the organization round every weekend. As he said,
you're
this time
more informed. Yep.
Advanced scout, but it was highly coincidental, of course, that they chose to do that particular episode of this.
Yeah,
series.
It's really coincidental that they would choose to cover their advanced scout when he was actually scouting the team they're playing. The week before. It's kind of what advanced scouts do. Anyway, they cleared it apparently with the Bengals and the Bengals.
With the Browns, they cleared it with, not the Bengals.
With the Browns, yeah. And now the crazy thing is, as I think Mike Tenier pointed out, do you really need to try to steal the Bengals signals when they're calling a fourth and goal at the four quarterback draw for Andy Dalton? I mean, you know, if you were doing that, your guy would just break out laughing. It makes no sense from a cheating point of view. If you were assuming that they're cheaters, why would you know, this is the last game you would need to do this.
Sure.
You know, and I don't think it's a slam dunk win for the Patriots, to be honest, against the Bengals. But nevertheless, this is not what you're doing. But because it's the Patriots, and because, you know, every time something happens, they're the Yankees, the 1950s Yankees, in the team that the world loves to hate.
So, what happens with it, Mike? Do you think there is any fallout? Because if it's illogical, and you make some really good arguments as to why,
I think the NFL office has already said that penalties would be minimal, if at all.
So, okay, let's move on from that particular Patriots story to the one that, in many respects, was a significant one this weekend, overshadowed, of course, by the extraordinary game in New Orleans. But the Patriots-Chiefs game, nevertheless, was pretty compelling. And the Patriots, as we talked about on Monday's show with Nicky Bandini, quite understandably, Mike, feel a little bit robbed with what went down there. You had the Stephon Gilmore fumble return for the touchdown that was whistled up too early, so it negated the taking it to the house. And then you had, even more visibly, the N'Keal Harry touchdown that wasn't, which left a lot of people baffled as to why the officials didn't just call the touchdown, knowing any touchdown call has to get reviewed, as opposed to calling him out of bounds when he wasn't. And those two calls, either one, but certainly both of them would have won the game for the Patriots, you would think. So,
it would have put them in a position to win the game, at least.
If both of them been given, they would have. Yeah, exactly. So what do you make of those two calls, how they happen, why they happen? And I know you are very, very vocal and passionate about the inconsistency and the lack of caliber in officiating crews, certainly in terms of depth in the NFL. So what gets done, what can get done about this? We talk about it every single year and nothing seems to improve.
Yeah. And what happens every year is that as the season winds down and the better games get flexed into prime time, or the bigger audiences start watching the best game that's available in the earlier slots, there's more attention paid. If those calls had been made in the Bengals Browns game, there would have been a little bit of a hoo-ha, but not much. But when, you know, it's like New Orleans and the Rams last year. It's when the audience is the biggest that the mistakes get amplified. But having said that, the Patriots had won 21 straight games at home. The last time they lost, the referee was Jerome Boger. And Jerome Boger was the referee again.
Yes, he was.
Now, I'm not saying it's a conspiracy or anything like that, but it is a coincidence. And coincidence is not causation. But the weird thing is, and the worst thing in both cases, you nailed it on the N'Keal Harry touchdown. If the guy who's supposed to make the call on whether or not he's in bounds doesn't know, the guy who is there to make the call as to whether he's gone into the end zone and thinks that he stepped out of bounds shouldn't make that call, because he knows that if he calls touchdown, it will be reviewed. Now, he also knows the Patriots have used up their challenges so that it can't be reviewed, which is why people are talking, you know, conspiracy. And the part about using up your challenges, one was for a first down spot that was about a yard short, which replay clearly showed, but was not overturned when Belichick challenged. The second one was on that fumble, not that it's a touchdown, because the whistle did blow, although it blew after Gilmore had picked the ball up, not before. And but the referee still did not even admit it was a fumble. They ruled him down by contact. So Belichick had to challenge that simply to get possession of the ball on the fumble. And that, of course, was correct. Now, the rule is if you challenge twice and they're both correct, you get a third challenge. But the rule really should be that if you challenge correctly, you keep that challenge. Because obviously what we saw was one of these situations where there was nothing you could do, even though the call was so obviously wrong on the N'Keal Harry touchdown. Now, the same referee also experienced a momentary blindness on the blitz. If you remember, there was a blitz on a third down play before the field goal. And Tony Romo was saying, oh, they're coming. Everybody's coming. You know, Brady's got to find the right receiver and get it out quickly, which he did to Philip Dorsett. The only problem was that Fuller had Dorsett in a bear hug, literally, pinning both his arms against his body as the ball went past. And the same official, the down judge on the sidelines, was sitting there watching it and signaled incomplete. And then what really irks me is Fuller was doing this kind of no, you can't do that. Yes. And that to me was the worst call of the game. But since the NFL this season, during the season, has put out a referee's advisories that you don't blow fumbles dead when the ball's being picked up and recovered, you can't understand why they would blow it dead at that point.
I guess it made
no sense whatsoever.
It's a really fair point. And I suppose with both of them, with the N'Keal Harry and that one, the defense for the reason the calls happen was that these are human beings and it's the moment. And sometimes you overlook that, I think, that assume that officials are automated machines that have no sense of emotion. And the heat of the how experienced they are, particularly if they're not wildly experienced, in the heat of the moment when you've got 80,000 fans screaming and it's crunch time and there is this action and speed that it happens and all of that thrown in, maybe he did think he saw N'Keal's Harry foot touch the white. Maybe.
Well, he did. Just, oh, for sure he did. Ooh. But he was checking on it. So if he thinks he saw it and he's checking with the guy whose call it is, and the guy whose call it is said, oh, I didn't see it, because I think they didn't want to make a decision is what it comes down to, then he should really
revert to the score.
He should really revert to what he knows will be something
a fail-safe assessment. Yeah.
You know, just like they micromanage the officials so much. Mm. That it's impossible that they did not realize that when a ball comes out, you know, let it play out and then review it if it's a fumble.
But I just wonder whether in the cold light of day, that's the logical thing. But, you know, in the emotion and the instinct, well, they kind of kicking in.
That's why they're referees.
Yeah, they're pros. It's a fair argument. Let's just move on quickly on another thing on officiating I want to ask you about before we roll forward to some other subjects. In terms of the big change, or one of the big changes anyway, going into this season post the NFC Championship game last year, enabling pass interference calls not given to be challenged. Now, right. I've only got stats through week 12 here, and this is via a New York Times article. So, but I'd imagine the trend hasn't changed dramatically in the last couple of weeks. A 15 of 77 reviews of pass interference were overturned, right? But as the article points out, half of those reversals, seven of the 15, were initiated by officials in the replay booth, responsible for challenges in the last 2 minutes of the half, right? So it has been pretty much all season long, Mike, one of the main narratives here in relation to officiating, that this grand rule that got brought in for all the right reasons after the Saints were robbed in the championship game just isn't working. So it gets brought in with a whole lot of hoo-ha and fanfare, but actually the practical application of it is just bunk and nobody's buying it.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that occurred in the Jets Dolphins game, because the play that set the Jets up for the winning field goal was overturned in New York. The ruling was overturned. Oh,
that's
in New
right.
York and Flores, deemed pass interference. And the problem is not review per se. The problem is nobody knows what pass interference is or isn't.
Yeah.
There was a play in the Baltimore Buffalo game where Cole Beasley was running deep with Marlon Humphreys, who before Fuller came along was my candidate for the Steve Nelson flag waiting to be thrown award. So he's chasing Beasley. He's right behind him. And Josh Allen unleashes a Josh Allen pass, which is going 10 or 15 yards over Beasley's head. And Humphrey not content with that, gives Beasley makes a little contact with Beasley's back. And Beasley did a soccer move. he basically fell like Messi, on a breakaway and, drew the pass interference flag. And
I'd take Neymar more than Messi, I would say that. Histrionic guy.
Yeah. And, so I was sitting there thinking, challenge that because it wasn't a catchable ball. So even if he did hit him, and even if you thought, there's no pass interference, if the guy could not possibly have gotten to the ball, but they didn't challenge it, and that stood up. The problem is that the rule used to be that when the ball's in the air, you can't touch the receiver. Mm-hmm. The Pereira-ism is now that you can't gain a significant advantage by contacting the receiver. And as we've seen repeatedly, and I make the point repeatedly, the receiver has to catch the ball. The defender only has to stop him from catching the ball, mm-hmm. which means he doesn't have to worry about catching the ball. And if you try to catch the ball with somebody pulling one of your arms back, that's a significant advantage. If somebody pushes you just as you're about to catch it, that's a significant advantage. If like Kendall Fuller did, you grab both his arms, that's a significant advantage. And sometimes they see it and sometimes they don't, and then you hear them saying, oh, well, they're just two guys face guarding. Well, they're not supposed to. If you're trying to catch the ball, if you're running a pattern and you have to catch the ball, you can't be face guarding. You can't be hand fighting. That's just two guys hand fighting. If you're hand fighting, how do you get in position to be where you're supposed to be to catch the ball? The whole rule is ridiculous. It's kind of like the NBA, I keep saying.
Yeah.
No harm, no foul. Except in the NBA, if you hit the guy's shooting hand, you're going to get a foul call. While he's got the ball.
It's clear cut. Yeah.
Yeah. And smart coaches like Pete Carroll, who, originally was a defensive back coach, and I think he sort of set the pace for everybody, teach their guys to follow, to stay within contact, which is why guys like Richard Sherman are so good, because although they're not quick or as quick as some of the others, he's long, he's got long arms, long legs, he can run with a guy and keep within reach. And when you see the receiver's eyes or his hands go up to make a play, you then get your hand in between them, whatever. And usually what happens is you get your hand on his hand, you get your hand on his chest, you might even get your hand on his face.
Yeah.
And it makes it hard for him to catch the ball. But that is basically the way that pass defense is played in man coverage nowadays by most teams, especially by the outside corners. And, if you think back to the years when face guarding was against the rules, in other words, you could not wave your hands in front of the guy's eyes if you weren't playing the ball. And, we see so many completions as well because guys don't know where the ball is. The receiver does. So, a great strategy when you need a first down or a big play is to send your receiver one-on-one downfield and underthrow him.
Yeah, sure.
And the receiver comes back for the ball, and the defender who has no idea where the ball is has to basically foul him.
Mm. Draw the flag, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean the Ravens lived on that for years with Joe Flacco and Torrey Smith. They were good. Any key game, they were good for a flag there. So, Mike Lombardi, I listened to the other day, and he sort of blames Al Riveron, who he calls Rip Van Winkle. And Al's only woke up, he says, in the last couple of weeks. But I think it's basically more, it's deeper than that. It's that the way the rules are written, it's completely a subjective call. And you can't, there's the benefit of the doubt is automatically in favor of the defender. Because as I said, the defender only has to do a little bit. Holding is a similar problem. In that, unless you really wrestle a guy to the ground or get your hand around his neck or head, you don't see many holds called. And when you do see them, they're often really what you would have to say, minor
tenuous
violations, given how major violations that don't get called are.
It is particularly just the final line on this, and we'll roll on. As you say, Mike, it is and brilliantly described how it favors the defensive back more often than not. But at the same time, one of the more maddening things of modern NFL has been the number of flags that are thrown and the fractious nature of games as a result of that. And we understand why that is the case, but it just adds to the general sense of confusion and as you've always said, the inconsistency that is fervent in the league at the moment with it. Let's move on to, I want a quick line on the NFC East race, if I may, just because of Monday Night Football, obviously.
There's a race?
Apparently, yeah. But, well, yeah, define race.
It's like this potato and spoon race, where there's a sock race at a kid's school.
Sports day, yeah. One of them has to win, apparently. Although, where are you on that? Do you think a team that, irrespective of whether they won the division or not, doesn't post a winning record, they should be allowed in the playoffs?
It doesn't really bother me. It's the way it is. Divisions could produce not so great records because three teams are really good, as much as four teams being really bad. So I'm okay with it.
Okay. With the Eagles win on Monday Night Football against the Giants, the return of Eli, of course, who looked like a good Eli of the past in the first half and then completely disappeared along with the rest of the Giants offense in the second half.
Yeah. There was a great play where he fumbled a snap down in the red area, at like about the 6 yard line. Mm-hmm. And I thought Daniel Jones could do that.
Yeah, right. Well, Eli's getting a swan song, of course, with the Jones injury. And it was almost someone might have made this point and I've just subconsciously plagiarized it. But it was almost a perfect microcosm of Eli's career, wasn't it, this game? Looked really sharp and promising.
There was a Mario Manning. One of those passes was like a Mario Manningham pass. He dropped it in. Slayton should be getting some notice, fifth round rookie. But yeah, he dropped it in over the shoulder, just perfectly. But then you also had that great flea flicker where Barkley turns around and there's like two Eagles between him and Manning as he tosses the ball back to Manning, and Manning almost literally like a volleyball player just pushed it right back to Barkley. You take it.
Like it was 400 degrees Fahrenheit or something. Quick line on who you think is likely to eke out the divisional win in the East.
I'm still going with Dallas, I guess. They're a more talented team right now. Lane Johnson, I don't know what his situation is going to be, but he's hurt. Jeffrey, I think, is out for the season. And Wentz is like Brady. It's like Wentz has no trust in any of his receivers except Ertz. Yeah. And you can't keep going to Ertz all the time, you know? Yeah. It's one of those where any way you look at it, you lose, you know? But I suspect the Cowboys are going to be able to win. Let me think. Let me just look quickly now. Philadelphia is at Washington, so they should win that. Then Dallas is at Philadelphia, which normally you would say that gives the Eagles an advantage, but they haven't been great at home, as we saw on Monday. Sure. And then Philadelphia is at the Giants. So the Eagles should pick up two wins right there, whereas Dallas has the Rams and then finishes with Washington. So really the key game in this is Dallas and the Rams. Mm. The Eagles could go in a game ahead of Dallas this week. And then if they beat the Cowboys, the season series is even. Mm-hmm. And they've won it. So, watch the Rams. That's the key in this one. I'm already talking, against myself here.
As you often do. So the Easter, neither of those teams, I think, are going to appear in our next part of the show. Iron Mike's Iron Rankings. So this is your top 10 power rankings.
Oh, yeah. Into the league just before right we now. Leave the Eagles, you know what they need is John Dorenbos back, the long snapper.
Oh, right. Okay. Tell
us more. Snapper got it. Before Monday Night Football, he was on with ESPN. He did a magic trick with Randy Moss where he gave a card to Randy Moss. Randy Moss puts it back in the deck. And then he said he throws the cards in the air and Randy Moss catches one card. And he says, is that the card you put in the deck? Randy Moss says, no. And so he starts looking for the card and there's a football in front of Randy Moss. Mm. He takes the football, takes out a knife and cuts the, the football open and pulls Randy Moss's card out of the football.
Wow. Awesome. What did Randy Moss do?
Randy Moss went crazy.
Oh, brilliant.
It was great. And I think I know how he did. I mean, I know how he did it. But
Tell me that off air. You'd never reveal the secrets of the magic circle.
We don't want to spoil, but I said, that's what they need. The Eagles need a magician out there.
Sure. The ball just appears. We're actually in the end zone. No one quite knows how after the ball is snapped. I love it. All right. To Iron Mike's Iron Rankings. These are your power rankings. Top 10 in the NFL right now. AFC, NFC, doesn't matter where you are in the division. So therefore, seeding slightly put to one side. Who are the best teams in the league right now based on Iron Mike's?
Okay. Top 10. It's sort of like the group, the gang of four. Which is really the gang of three plus one, but it's the gang of four from 7 to 10 is Tennessee, Minnesota, Green Bay, and the Rams.
So the Rams being 10, presumably.
The Rams being 7.
The Rams being 7. Oh, okay.
But I mean, like I say, Green Bay and the Rams were probably 7, you know, are probably in a tie for 7. Minnesota just behind them and Tennessee would be 10. Then you've got, Kansas City, Seattle, and New England. Right now, I would say New England 6, Seattle 5, Kansas City 4. And the thing with the Patriots is they're not a very good team, and they need everything to go right if they're going to beat anybody who is good. They haven't won a game where the opposition has scored more than 14 points, and they're very good at keeping. They held the Chiefs to 3 points in the second half of that game.
Sure.
You know, and if they hadn't had a field goal blocked, it would have been better. And that's the kind of play the Patriots don't usually surrender. They blocked a punt. They got a touchdown out of that. But, you know, everything has to go right for them in order to win.
Devlin's out for the season, right?
There's no Devlin's reason. Been out for the season since like week 3 or 4.
Oh, no, he's been out, but he's out for the season. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the huge differences. Almost more so than receivers. You saw they tried to go run at the beginning of that game against Kansas City, without much success. They don't have Gronk. They don't have Trent Brown, and they don't have Devlin. So when you were running behind those three guys, which is what Sony Michel is kind of like, a follow the fullback kind of runner, you know, that was devastating. But Isaiah Wynn's not a bad run blocker. Tooney's not a bad run blocker, but they've got a linebacker playing fullback. And they can't dominate the way they did. And Wynn really had a tough time with Frank Clark in that game. Pass blocking, and Karras, the center, who's replaced Josh Andrews, who's out for the season. Karras just doesn't have the bulk, to be able to hold off good interior rushers or move them out of the way, which Andrews, although he's also a finesse blocker, can do that. So, you know, the Patriots, you can't write them off because, you know, they can always prepare for a game and play really well, but they don't have the talent of the Chiefs or the Seahawks. The top three teams are pretty
just
obvious.
Just quickly, Mike, before you get to the top three, just on the Seahawks and Rashad Penny's injury, as is always the way when a key player goes down, it's going to weaken them. But how significantly with this particular offensive makeup?
It's a bit. I mean, they want to run the ball, and giving Carson rest was a real positive thing for them because when they were, you know, Tennessee, the Vikings are kind of the same team in a sense that they all need to run the ball and control it, to make their game plan work. Oakland is a similar team. When Tennessee was playing Oakland, it was like watching the same team on both sides of the ball, except Oakland didn't have Josh Jacobs and they didn't have Tannehill running. They have Carr. So, I think that makes a big difference for Seattle. If they can't control the ball, then they have to really rely on Russell Wilson making plays. And, you know, DK Metcalf's going to make plays. Lockett's going to make plays. Josh Gordon really doesn't look like he is going to make plays. But they're always dangerous for that reason. They're not as good defensively as we think they are, you know, because they're Seattle. We kind of give them an extra bonus.
Yeah, for sure.
And Kansas City, they played pretty well. I mean, Spagnuolo knows what to do against Brady, which is bring pressure up the middle. And a lot of other teams will try to do that. But they needed a few breaks in terms of coverage because when you do that, you need your corners have to be able to man cover. And the Patriots make that easy because they don't have a receiver that you can't man cover. They doubled Edelman for most of the game, and Brady had no one else to really go to with any consistency. And as I said, the biggest non-call of that game was the one when Kendall Fuller, because Kendall Fuller can't man cover a receiver. Not even Philip Dorsett, who's not the top three.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you order them because they played each other, right? New Orleans, Baltimore, San Francisco. I like what San Francisco did on the road, so I've put them at number one, with Baltimore two and New Orleans three.
Yeah.
But really, when you look at those games, the San Francisco, Baltimore, the San Francisco, New Orleans game, they could have gone either way.
Either way, sure.
Those are three really solid teams on both sides of the ball. I think that the Saints are not as good offensively or defensively as I thought they were at the start of the season.
But they just put up 40 whatever points on the best defense in the NFL.
Yeah, they still can produce. And Breeze, who I thought was not looking as good as he had at the start of the season, still doesn't seem to have this much zip on the ball, but he was certainly putting the ball where it needed to be. I mean, it was a masterclass in accurate passing.
Yeah.
They do rely a lot on Michael Thomas. San Francisco stopped them from running the ball, which is a real key for them, because they work so much off play action. The Niners can do it in any number of different ways.
Well, let me ask you about that, Mike, because keen on your perspective on this. On the one hand, people are celebrating, and rightly so, the innovative or imaginative play calling of Shanahan and diving into his box of tricks and finding different ways to beat the Saints. Is that something that I don't want in the game, right? So it makes a lot of sense that was the game plan, but is there an element of that you think Shanahan is going to look at the typical offense and be concerned that he had to revert to those kind of plays to get the job done against? Okay, it's a solid New Orleans defense, but they're maybe not one of the best defenses in the NFL. Do you follow my lead?
They've got a good front and they've got some great defensive backs.
Sure, Lattimore.
Lattimore. What Shanahan's doing is what Atlanta did when he was their offensive coordinator and they went to the Super Bowl and had a 28-3 lead over the Patriots. Mm. He attacks you on different levels. He's really good at creating openings for people. He's got a great tight end, who to run that middle level, like Kelsey does for the Chiefs, like Ertz does for the Eagles. They use him very well with Emmanuel Sanders and with Deebo Samuel sort of coming into his own. He now has receivers who can fill those other levels. Sanders is, if the Patriots had picked up Sanders, and I think that when he went on the market, Elway was no way he was going to give Sanders to the Patriots, regardless of what the price was. But they got him for a second and a third, which is a pretty good deal. He gives them so much more flexibility in what they do. And if they have all three of their running backs in place, Mostert, who I used to do when he was at Purdue, and he couldn't do a lot because Purdue's line was always being overpowered by the other Big Ten teams. But he returned kicks and stuff. He's a very explosive back with really good running skills. And they ran the trick play with Sanders to Mostert, but there was Mostert wide open. But with Breida and Mostert and Tevin Coleman, who barely played against the Saints, but had a pretty good game the week before. I just think he's got so many options and he's got a fullback, who he can use and does use in various ways.
Who is no nonsense, is Danny. When he got pancake, just bounced straight up for the next play. No chance of going off.
Really, the only difference is how good is Jimmy Garoppolo? How far is Jimmy Garoppolo going to take it? Because when you look at what they do, Garoppolo's not making the kind of big play throws that you might want if you're going to go all the way, the kind of breeze. So they're more yards after the catch kind of thing, which is the way his offense is designed to work. So if he hits Kittle in stride, if he hits Sanders in stride, they're going to pick up yards after the catch, but he doesn't drop in the bombs very, very often, the way Mahomes might or Breeze might or Wilson will. And that's really the major difference. Baltimore is a thing unto themselves, right? Because they're running an offense that nobody else can run, based on Lamar Jackson. So they're going to go pretty much as far as that takes them. But since they've got Marcus Peters and Jimmy Smith is back, they're so deep in the secondary
right
that it's hard to make plays against them. because that secondary does very well.
Well, they just messed Josh Allen. I mean, he was blitzed. I think they blitzed 30 times, I was reading.
Sacked him, I think, six times. Yeah. But more importantly, they kept him in the pocket.
Yeah. And he was outside of the pocket. I saw a stat that he was 0-11 outside of the pocket. When he did get out, he was so hurried and just couldn't get any. And he only had one downfield throw of 15 yards or more.
And he only ran the ball twice.
Right.
And I think it was 9 yards he picked up. And so that was pretty much, you know, Buffalo's defense against them was very, very good. And I think a lot of teams will be looking. But part of that is you have to have the way they did it. You have to have a safety who can sit and read and make the plays. Or a linebacker. They did it with Tremaine Edmonds. But I was thinking of the Steelers using Minkah Fitzpatrick, say, in a similar kind of role last week. You basically had him waiting to see where the play was going and then trying to crash the play at an angle. And it worked pretty well. They weren't able to run that kind of power, pistol power, whatever you want to call it, kind of attack that makes them work.
Right. I'm going to dive into the mailbag. I'm Mike at the NC Show, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter is how you get in touch with the show. Fire them in all week long, incidentally, gang. And it doesn't have to be the day of record or day before, the show. We will, we'll save them up, the goodies and wheel them out, for the big man. So, let's go first with Colin. Thanks for this, Colin. He says, is Austin Ekeler going to have to leave the Chargers to be their number one running back?
That's a good question. I don't think he's going to be a number one running back in most of the places he goes to. Austin Ekeler is, you know, going to be like Alvin Kamara or Kareem Hunt. He's going to be like Matt Breida. These are the guys who, you know, are sort of like his skill set. Mm-hmm. And they're more effective if they're sharing the load with another runner, usually a guy who's a power runner, you know, like Ingram or Latavius Murray, or whatever. So I think he's in a good situation right now, because you don't want to be giving him lots and lots of touches. You want to be using him creatively. And he had just a brilliant game against Jacksonville, who basically, I mean, shoot them now, they're dead. I picked them to win that game. I don't know. I'm not quite sure why, but they were just horrible. Defensively, they weren't tackling. They were playing like a team whose hearts weren't in it.
Yeah. I was just, reading the question. Austin Ekeler won't be the Chargers' number one running back if he has to leave. So there's either a brilliant question from Colin on an existential level, or I think to be a number one running back, I think is what he was getting at.
It's like that internet meme that went around yesterday with this big garbage dumpster outside a building, and it stenciled on the dumpster was empty when full.
Oh, I love it. Here's one for you, Mike. If there was a most achieved with the least talent award, who would win?
team or individual?
Well, this is Richard. It suggests Brian Flores, which is a little bit harsh. I quite like what... So I'm with you now. So most achieved with the least talent. So coach, I'm guessing is what.
Yeah. Saying. Most achieved with the least talent is a coach.
And
right
the reverse.
Now, right now, you know what no one notices is Bill Belichick.
Right.
That team is not a 10-3 team on paper. I mean, yes, they've played an easy schedule, but so has Miami. You know, they're playing basically the same schedule as Miami. But yeah.
His other least achieved with the most talent is presumably Jason Garrett, I guess.
I think that's kind of automatic. Doug Peterson's got to be in that race though, too. You know, it's like people might jump and say Pittsburgh, but Pittsburgh's got a lot of talent on that team, especially on defense. Their running back situation's a mess, but
Juju's been out a lot as well. That's not a bad shot, Mike Tomlin. But yeah, Flores, I think it's got to be up there.
I mean, Tomlin's going to get a lot of Coach of the Year votes.
But Vrabel. Oh, what about McDermott?
Tennessee's McDermott's a good shout, although there is a lot of talent on that team.
Offensively, not so much, though, is there?
Yeah, offensively, not so much, but they've built it the way they want to build it. Yeah, right. McDermott's a very good shout. Tennessee is a talented team. Mm. You know, when they're healthy on the offensive line, if Corey Davis would ever come back and play like the guy who's supposed to be Corey Davis. They're a good defensive team. They're solid on both sides, but But I think they, you know, Vrabel's done a nice job of sort of sticking to things with them. And you know, they've got two games with Houston in the next 3 weeks, which will be great because that's going to decide the division.
Mike, if our listeners want to get more of your stylings, patreon.com/MikeCarlsonFMTE. We'll push that link out on our social channels as well. All your picks for, where are we, week 15?
Oh my God. I'll tell you what. I looked at the NFL Pick Watch site, and the number one in that standings is not a person, but AccuScore, which is one of the computer programs. Who picked 139 games correctly. And guess how many Iron Mike has picked correctly?
138.
139.
You're the same as AccuScore. I love this
idea. So me and AccuScore would be leading the nation, all the pundits AccuScore in the U.S., all the guys at ESPN, all the guys at NFL Network, you know, they're all behind me and AccuScore.
Well, you are ESPN now, my friend. Hey, incidentally, what we should do if we get to week 17 and you and AccuScore are still neck and neck, we should
I've probably blown kind of special, it by mentioning it.
Some kind of AccuScore will be listening to this. He obviously, presumably, can listen to any podcast that is released because he can just simultaneously listen to 5,000 shows to gain information, gain an edge. But you versus AccuScore.
Me versus AccuScore.
He picks a live show, a bit like the LeBron James decision, where we just go game by game, you're picking them, and then you have to state, you and AccuScore, just imagine this giant 80-star computer live on a TV show. We've got to make that happen, I'm like.
Yeah, absolutely. I was all prepared to do a top five on the best announcing pairs, which somebody I think asked for.
Oh, we'll have to wheel that.
Since you trumped me by making me do a top 10 off the top of my head. If you guys listening, send in your picks for who the best announcing pairs are. And we'll see how they match up against mine next week.
All right, lovely stuff. Yeah, fire those in at the NC show. We'll get into it next week. That's a promise. We've got a Christmas special coming up soon as well. You're coming to ESPN HQ for that one, I think.
Yeah.
And you got a Christmas jumper sorted.
Well, I've got my Christmas hat for it.
Okay. Oh God. Okay. All right. I'll look forward to that. Try and wheel out a Christmas jumper as well, Mike. I think it's obligatory.
Iron Mike don't do Christmas jumpers.
We'll have to wheel out some Iron Mike Singers Christmas as well.
Wear my Bill Belichick Let's Party sweatshirt.
Oh, definitely wear that. Please wear that. That's a lock and a load. All right. Cracking stuff. Iron Mike. We'll see you next week.
Okay. So have a good time.
Fine work from Iron Mike. He'll be back next week with his top five. He was, I think, annoyed that we didn't wheel out the top five, given the fact he'd worked heavily on that. But I tell you what, as he said, we'll fire it out on the social media channels at the NC show. Put your suggestions forward for your favorite broadcasting duo of all time, and we will discuss them on next week's show, see if they align with Iron Mike's thinking as well. Big shout out to Touchdown Trips. If you are thinking, scratching your head, about Christmas presents for nearest and dearest, we'll go to touchdowntrips.com/gift-vouchers. touchdowntrips.com. You'll find the gift vouchers tab on there, the full URL /gift-vouchers. Easy peasy, really. Stocking filler perfection is what I'm going to say there. The gift vouchers there. Touchdown Trips, organizing all kinds of travel to the States for NFL games, for college games, high school games, outside of the NFL as well. If you're loving your American sports, they're the go-to guys for that too. What's not to love about that? So boost your creds and Christmas creds with some Touchdown Trips prezzies. I hope Ben Isaacs is listening to this bit, not just jumping to his bit, because then he can get me something from them for my Christmas present. I'm pretty sure that everybody on the show is getting me a present, right? I hope that's good. That could get quite awkward. Right, let's get into the college chat and the Heisman with Ben Isaacs. Benedict Isaacs, what's going on?
Oh, I'm just enjoying the college football season and getting excited about bowl season, or as everyone else calls it, Christmas.
How was championship weekend for you? Did you watch every single game ever?
I certainly watched far too much, and I'm still suffering because of it. But it was all worth it. You know, you want to see the champions, and you want to know exactly who deserves to be in the playoffs and know what you're getting when the playoffs arrive.
Well, the playoffs sorted, of course. So, and as we worked together on radio on Sunday and rolled in, and they'd just been announced, officially announced, but I said, any surprise there? And he said, no, not really, based on what had happened over the weekend.
Yeah, it seemed pretty clear cut. Once Oregon had beaten Utah, that took Oregon and Utah both out of it. They both finished 11-2. They were not going to put Oregon, a two-loss conference champion, in the playoff. They were done. It was then a matter of whether Georgia could do something against LSU and who would win out of Baylor and Oklahoma. And LSU just destroyed Georgia 37-10. Wasn't close. That took Georgia out of it. And it came down to Baylor and Oklahoma. And I did say this was going to be the game of the week, and it was the game of the week. It went to overtime. Oklahoma won 30-23. And that slotted them in at number four because Clemson won comfortably, Ohio State won comfortably. So we've got three unbeaten conference champions plus one loss Oklahoma. Now, the decision the playoff committee had to make was who's going to be number one, because going into the weekend, it was Ohio State. But I think most people would agree that LSU looked the best on Saturday, beating a really good Georgia team. So LSU got the number one seed, then Ohio State, then Clemson, then Oklahoma. And you really, this year, really want to be number one, because you don't want to have to play one of those three unbeaten teams. So LSU have certainly got the easier task facing Oklahoma. And don't get me wrong, this Oklahoma team is really good, but they are certainly not in the class of Clemson and Ohio State. That Clemson-Ohio State game will be absolutely unreal. This may be the best four-team playoff field we've ever had, but it looks weird because there's no Alabama. It's the first year that there's ever been a playoff without Alabama.
Right, there you go. The championship game on January the 13th, of course. So all to play for. Just a quick line on the bowl season for the uninitiated. So obviously we've got a lot of NFL fans listening to the show. Hopefully have got on the college train this season. Significant because of your involvement
of
as
course.
Well. But, entirely because of your involvement.
That's yeah.
So maybe haven't got to this stage of proceedings before. I have a loose understanding of what's going on, but talk us through it for the uninitiated.
So the bowl games will take place around Christmas and New Year. The first one actually this year is on the 20th of December, and they go through until the 6th of January. And they sort of peak around New Year's Day. The biggest ones are around New Year. And back in the old days, you only had a handful of bowl games, and they were partly created to fuel tourism. It was to get fans from the Midwest and the East Coast out to California and out to the South, where it would be hot and they'd have a little bit of a holiday and they would spend money. And it would be a great reward for the players, and it would be quite an achievement getting to a bowl game. Now it's less of an achievement because there's so many bowl games, and because, you know, you've got to have a winning record to kind of qualify. So now there's absolutely loads, and sometimes you get people saying there's too many, but I don't understand that argument. There can never be too many. For it's not, you don't have to watch them if you don't want to. But if you love the game, then the fact that you've got a game or sometimes two or three every single day over the Christmas period is fantastic. I mean, I'll be going away at Christmas, and I'll make sure that I've got like a streaming stick that I can stick into my TV or a Chromecast, so that I can get ESPN player on that, so I can watch it Christmas Eve and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, there's games Friday the 20th, the 21st, the 23rd, the 24th. You know, there always seems to be a game in Hawaii on Christmas Eve,
and if there should be.
Exactly.
We've got to make sure we go out for that next year.
ESPN, make it happen. We'll do a live broadcast from Honolulu on Christmas Eve. It'll be the top rated, downloaded podcast that ESPN has ever put out. I guarantee it.
I love it.
I don't know how families will feel about it, but you know.
Nah, they can come. We can work it out.
As these games loom into view, the bigger games, then obviously we'll have the opportunity to discuss them, but the biggest ones around New Year will include the playoff semifinals, as well as the traditional bowl games.
And one thing to remember without getting too melancholic is that for those teams that haven't made a bowl game or still in the playoffs, for all those players in those teams in their final year, that could be the last game of football they've ever played, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an emotional thing for them, and it's a big deal for a lot of these kids who are traveling, and they'll go to places they haven't had the chance to play before, because if you play for a smaller team in, say, the Midwest, you don't necessarily get the chance to go and play in Florida or in California. But what we're finding with a lot of the bowl games now is sometimes the people who are projected to go at the top of the draft, they are starting to skip games. And it happens less in the bigger bowl games, you know, the Rose Bowl and the Orange Bowl and so on. But in the smaller ones, sometimes a player will think, do you know what? I'm not going to risk this. But when it comes to those playoff games, the intensity in the college football playoff.
We'll risk it for injury because of the NFL draft, you mean?
Yeah, because they'll feel that, you know, okay, yeah, it would be nice to win the Camping World Bowl, for example, which is in Orlando. You know, that's a nice little trip. And that's Notre Dame versus Iowa State, in case you're wondering. You don't necessarily want to risk just so you can lift the Camping World Bowl trophy. You don't want to risk, you know, a fractured leg and tumble down the draft. I just want to say, if you are thinking the playoffs, those are both the night of the 28th of December, Saturday, 28th of December. Oklahoma versus LSU is at 9 p.m. That's from Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta. And then at 1 a.m., straight afterwards, Clemson versus Ohio State, and that's at State Farm Stadium, home of the Arizona Cardinals.
Lovely stuff. Just a quick one on the Heisman race. Obviously, given Tua's injury, that takes him out of it. Who is the smart money on?
I would say there's no smart money because it is such a foregone conclusion. In the same way that it felt like when we went into the college football selection announcement, we knew who the four would be. The only argument was which one would be one and two. We know that this is going to be Joe Burrow. The only question is whether he managed to accumulate more votes or a bigger victory than anyone else in history. He is that far ahead. Wow. In the minds of the voters.
Jalen Hurts is in the mix, right?
Jalen Hurts. There are only four people have been invited. Jalen Hurts, right, the quarterback of Oklahoma, who transferred from Alabama. Justin Fields, the quarterback of Ohio State, who transferred from Georgia. Chase Young, the defensive end from Ohio State, who's probably the most talented player in the country right now. And Joe Burrow, who transferred from Ohio State.
Oh, so they're all transferred?
Yeah, it's all the quarterbacks. All the quarterbacks are transfer quarterbacks. And this is something that we are going to see a lot more of. And this is now starting to become a big thing. A quarterback who isn't getting playing time or feels they're not going to get past the incumbent. It's much easier for them to transfer now. Mm. And all those players moved on because there was a player ahead of them that they couldn't get past.
That didn't need to happen before. Is it because a lot of NFL teams would still draft a player even if they hadn't? I'm trying to think of an example. No, so thinking of Sanchez when he was the starter at USC, had one season, didn't he?
Yeah, he was just sitting because they had a real production line. No, yeah. The reason it happens more now is the rules have been relaxed. It used to be you had to get permission from more people, okay, and you would have to sit out a year and you would lose a year of eligibility. Mm. Now they have what they call the transfer portal. And you enter the
actual portal.
Well, it's like an online portal. You enter the transfer portal and you kind of have your pick of teams. It's great for players.
I love this idea of a transfer portal quantum leap.
Yeah.
You just walk into something, get beamed into. Where have I ended up?
Yeah. Then you're like, oh my God, Idaho.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's great for these quarterbacks. Joe Burrow, he desperately wanted to be, a star at Ohio State. He's from Ohio. He loved it there. And the thing is, the Ohio State fans still love Joe Burrow because he played his heart out. He just couldn't get past, Dwayne Haskins, now in Washington. So he just left, and LSU always seemed to, the reason they would never seem to be able to get past Alabama is they didn't have a quarterback who could make enough plays. And Joe Burrow had a very pedestrian season last year. He threw 16 touchdowns in 13 games, 16 touchdowns and 5 interceptions. This year, 48 touchdowns and 6 interceptions. Mm. His completion percentage is 77.9. Now, that obviously could go up or down during the playoffs, and he'll hope he's got two more games to play. But if it stays at 77.9, that will be the highest completion percentage in college football history. Now, Joe Burrow is not the best quarterback I've ever seen. I'm not saying that to be like he's average. I've seen better quarterbacks, but this season statistically is as good as any season that a college football quarterback has ever had. He will walk the Heisman, and I would be amazed if he doesn't get picked with the number one overall pick. I think he would have to have a pretty disastrous playoff and then not look good on his pro day. If he just kind of stands pat to where he is and does what he's been doing, then I think he will be the number one pick. He will win the Heisman and he's going to earn a lot of money. And maybe he's going to be back home in Ohio after all with the Cincinnati Bengals.
Looks that way. Although they'll probably beat the Patriots this weekend and go on a 3-game winning streak and blow that as well.
Well, with all that video, I mean, you know, sure. if anyone can sit through video of Bengals games, then I think they deserve a win.
Sure. And Mike has ruled himself out of the frame for being in Ohio last week involved in that. Patriots filming crew. That's what he says. I'm not sure I believe him. Ben, cracking stuff at tweets from Ben. If you want to follow Ben on Twitter for all college stylings and more, of course. And enjoy this weekend. And we will, and the Heisman on Saturday, right? So
yep.
Saturday night. So enjoy that. And we will check in with you next week.
Thank you. Speak to you soon.
Take care, mate. Fine work from Ben. He'll be back next week. So will I and Mike, of course. I wasn't lying. There is going to be a Christmas special with me and I and Mike. We're recording it on the 23rd of December. So a special Christmas special on the 23rd of December that we're recording at ESPN HQ. So extra video content as well. I will insist I and Mike wear some kind of Christmas jumper. Otherwise, he's not allowed on the show. So that is all to come in the 4 episodes every week, all the way to the Super Bowl, where we will be out in Miami, dropping episodes daily as we build up to the big game. So if you haven't already, subscribe to us wherever you are listening to us and you won't miss a trick. We will see you Friday. J-Bell in the house. Looking forward to it. See you then. Bye for now.